welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 most Tuesdays at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Rick Carey from Bristol Housing Action. He's a former squatter, and he's talking about homelessness in the city and what Bristol Housing Action are doing to stop it. He also tells us about the dynamic duo from Bristol City Council. Robin Denford evicts you, and then Richard Hawkridge criminalises you when you wind up on the streets. We're also hearing from George Samueli. He's a geopolitical analyst, writes for many websites, including antiwar.com, and he's the author of the 2013 book Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you've got a story or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Richard Carey. I'm a member of Bristol Housing Action Movement. The first campaign I was involved with in Bristol was a council house being sold off by George Ferguson up in Avonmouth. Managed to get a guy and his kid homed from that, got the council house back into public ownership. Then went on to, there's been housing association houses that we've defended. There's a few riot police in that. That was pretty intense.
When you say defended, is this also houses which the council or a housing association are trying to sell on the open market?
That's correct, yeah.
So what's the problem with that? They're their houses. They're not your houses, are they?
There are houses.
No, they're not.
And if they don't believe they are, then they need to be taught that they are.
Well, the council does have those houses. They are officially the council's property. They're also the same with the housing associations. They're their property, and if they have decided that for whatever reason they need to sell them off, they're just like a private landlord, surely.
It depends how you consider the council. If you want to live under the council like some sort of ruling body, then that's fair. But I see the council as a management company that manages our publicly owned assets, the things that we have paid for through our council tax, through our work, through our blood, sweat and tears. They are our buildings, and if they're being mismanaged, it's for us to step in and stop them.
So how did it go at Avonmouth? Did you manage to stop the sell-off?
We managed to stop the sell-off, and we actually had a wink and a nod from Marvin Rees, who said that he would never sell off any more council houses Yeah, he implied public assets, but we soon found out all the commercial from Bristol City Council was on the market as well.
So how has Marvin been since George? Obviously, George was selling off some of the council housing stock. What about Marvin? Has he fulfilled that pledge?
I think Marvin's definitely kind of outed himself as a real neoliberal. Everyone put their faith in him with all the Corbyn fever that was going on, as a socialist that would stand against the cuts, perhaps link up with the other mayors in the country. What we saw was pandering to the cuts, insensitive policies on homelessness, reduction in funding for the poor areas of Bristol, which happen to coincidentally be majority Labour voting areas, which you can...
Yeah, but the thing is, Marvin, if he was sitting here now, he'd say, Rick, it's not my decision. Actually, the money into the city council has been cut by the Tories in Westminster. So I cannot just simply keep putting money into things when I don't have as big a pie to go with in the first place.
That's a great spin that he would probably have been taught to repeat by Kevin Slocum, his personal minder, that probably cost a fair bit himself. But when he's spending so much money on evicting homeless people and creating injunctions, which essentially create no-go zones for homeless people within Bristol, you really need to question why he's spending money he doesn't have.
So why is he evicting homeless people? In what cases? Give us some examples.
There's the case of Greenbank. We had Greenbank, which was a group of van dwellers and caravan dwellers, also a homeless camp next to it as well. That area now has an injunction on. It didn't fit with his idea of what the city is.
Well, also there was some serious fires and violence and things like that there, weren't there?
Yes, that's right. And as soon as the guys left from down there, there was a burnt out car straight away. So it just shows that in areas that are out of the way in Bristol, you do actually have a lower level of car fires and other problems when you have people living there, because people don't want trouble where they live, whether they're homeless or van dwellers. There's a sense of calm that comes from people sleeping in a certain area.
But surely this isn't the place for caravans, it just in the streets. I mean, surely there should be sites, that sort of thing, for specific sites for people to live on, rather than just pitched up along by the curbside in an ordinary residential street, like up in Greenbank.
Sure, and getting back to how Marvin is acting, we understand that we need homes. We understand that there aren't homes currently for people that are in caravans, vans, that are homeless to get into. But that doesn't mean that you can evict people, bring injunctions onto people. If they have nowhere to go, you're just sweeping the problem to another town, another area, or even into the shadows, such as the riverbanks, where, what is it, 4 or 5 people have died now on the side of a river, hiding from the council, who should be helping them.
When you say that Marvin is a neoliberal, what do you mean by that? Explain yourself.
Marvin believes that the salvation of the city is in investment and development. He seems to want to go abroad to gather funds from places with great records, such as the Philippines and Georgia and other...
China, Malaysia.
Wow. Yeah. So he's searching for funds that are not accountable in a way, because I guarantee if he asked every single Bristolian for a £20 note, they would quite happily invest in what he's trying to sell to them, and then they would be the owners of that particular investment and they would have a say in it, which I think he's scared of doing. He's scared of opening up investment to the citizens of Bristol because he knows there's accountability there. He'd rather just fly off to some distant country, grab some money, come back and do what he wants to do.
But isn't he being a realist? Because actually, as I said, the government is giving Bristol City Council less and less money, virtually zero by 2020, and he's got to look elsewhere to get money coming into the city.
That is correct, and he hasn't looked at his citizens yet. You see that in the Knoll West development, which... I mean, I could go into this for another 5 minutes, but essentially it started off as asking the community to invest themselves so they would be the direct beneficiaries of the build over there. But instead, he wants to go with private investment. For me, it's accountability. You can't say that you're trying to save the city money when you're taking expensive legal fees to... you're asking people like Robin Denford, who is the Bristol City Council's main eviction man, to close laundries for tenants of buildings. Like my good friend who's now passed, Stephen Norman, who defeated him in the court and got his laundry back. But why spend that money? Why spend so much money and when you're talking about not having money and it being cut?
What would you like to see done?
I think in Bristol, you've got areas such as St Werburgh's that have always been van-friendly. You've got certain areas of Easton that are used to caravans. You've got sites all over the place. You've got people with real ideas. And I'm not just talking the kind of bespectacle, typical socialist bloke who's down the pub theorising. You've got people that are living alternatively in eco-villages, vans, squats, derelict buildings. These are people that can self-manage and therefore they are cheaper people to home. If a little tiny bit of authority was simply given over to these people to allow them to build their own dwellings or to live off the land in certain areas... I'm not saying it's a solution, but it's a saving. And why is he not considering that?
Well, does the council have enough land to do that sort of thing?
It certainly does. There's pieces of land that are not used all over Bristol. You just need to look at the acres of hoarded off land that's being kept speculated on. Down near the Cumberland Basin, you've got the old stonemasons next to Spike Island it's probably going to sit there until the Cumberland Basin gets the green light. You've got all the area that George Ferguson owns around Temple Island. If the arena doesn't go forward, that's going to be empty for ages. You've got little slivers of land that the National Rail have. There's plenty of room all over for people to just turn up and live in a caravan or somewhere that just gets them off the street. We hear that tents are the most dangerous things, so people must go into hostels. Well, why not a caravan? Why not a van? Why do they need to go into hostels? If tents are so dangerous, wouldn't you be happy for someone to be in a caravan, in a van instead?
Well, it seems obvious because quite a lot of people simply can't afford to pay the rent. I mean, this is even working people as well, isn't it, Rick?
Well, we're coming up to the, I don't know whether I've got my tinfoil hat on, but it does seem the end of days. It seems like there's another recession forecast. Yeah, it's great flying around the world and getting little bits of investment, but we need to really look into becoming a resilient city, not just a city that can fly around and get outside development from other places and pass on cuts. We need to start looking at our recycling and how we can make money out of it. We need to start looking at our empty land and how we can use it. We really need to give ourselves a big kick in the bottom and stop pandering to developers and take ownership of a city with a plan, with governance.
What is the situation where there's this place, I think it used to be, I'm not sure if it still is, called Phoenix House on Temple Street, which is where people who find themselves, for whatever reason, street homeless, that is to say maybe they've been kicked out of their dwelling because the universal credit doesn't cover their rent, this sort of thing. What sort of reception do people get there when they arrive and say, I'm homeless, I need somewhere to live?
There's a terrible amount of gatekeeping within Bristol City Council to stop people who are entitled to a duty of care pushing the council to home them. They've developed all different kinds of weird and wonderful routes away from being offered a council house. Now, I understand that their argument would be, say you talk to Paul Smith, you'd say, well, we just don't have the houses available.
Paul, he's the cabinet member for housing.
Yes, yes. But unfortunately, that doesn't justify treating people like dirt. You've got people that are extremely vulnerable, that are often misusing drugs to stop themselves killing themselves, and you're telling them that they have no route out of it except for a hostel that's known for violence or some kind of temporary accommodation that's filled with cockroaches. And it worries me because you always have a large amount of drug and drug use just to deal with the mental issues that you have when you're on the streets, and it's a real shame that the people we put in charge of our city are telling people that they're scum, that they're not worth anything, that they don't deserve a house, that they don't have any duty of care to support them, but they will happily take them to court and spend thousands evicting them from anywhere that they set up.
This sounds as if it's a way of punishing people who are just simply not able to fight back. Say, for example, if they were to do that to a wealthy person, they'd find themselves in the courts probably like a flash. But many of these people are extremely vulnerable. They've certainly got no access to any redress through the courts.
Well,
but even, you know, with the cutting of legal aid and that sort of thing, it's even worse.
If you do have legal representation, then apparently that's grounds to dismiss duty of care, because you can go and talk to a solicitor, so you shouldn't be homeless. That's what it's come to. So there's no...
It's a survival of the fittest. It's like, sounds to me a bit like the law of the jungle here in Bristol at the moment.
There's no discourse. It's a war now, isn't it? It's a class war. There's no point talking anymore. There's no point in any kind of discourse or sending emails or having protests or anything else. If people need a house, you need to kick down the back door or open a window and get in there and home someone.
I mean, are there still some rights for squatters? As I understand it, you know, commercial property, if it's empty, and there's quite a lot of those around, of course, because we're living in an era where big business is taking over, big cartels, the big chains are doing quite well, but actually quite a lot of the small retail shops, for example, are going to the wall. Small businesses are going to the wall and leaving buildings empty.
Well, residential properties were made illegal to squat under the Legal Aid Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act 2012. So that did deny a lot of empty properties to squatters who would quite happily have opened them up and used them. But yes, commercials are still fair game. But there's an ever-diminishing number of commercial properties that are empty. I mean, the best thing about a recession would be that there would be more empty commercial properties. But should that be the only option? If we are in a battle with the council and we quite happily take over as many of these places as we need to home people?
What sort of injunctions are we seeing at the moment? I've read up in Worcester that a woman was injuncted from begging. She asked somebody for 50 pence. She was overheard by a police officer, and it was She had to do, I believe it was 2 months in prison for that.
I think that would be around the Vagrancy Act, which is an extremely old act. I know that the Lib Dems, Anthony Negus, is the councillor in the Bristol that's pushing for an end to the Vagrancy Act, for it not to be enforced by the likes of Richard Hawkridge at Streetwise. There was a...
So what is Streetwise?
So Streetwise is an organisation headed by Richard Hawkridge. It's the council and police's enforcement arm, essentially. So he will go around the town centre and target at-risk individuals who often have reading problems, mental health difficulties, and he will force them off of the streets using the courts. Now, he won't just force them off the streets into a dark corner, he'll force them off the streets into his care, his personal care. So their financials, accommodation, what they do with their day, how they access benefits, what benefits they access, are all taken away from them and given to this man that wears sandals in October and wanders around the street like he's some sort of homeless Jesus.
Do you know what his official title, Richard Hawkridge, is?
He is the head of Bristol City Council and the police's outreach.
Does he ever have much to do with Robin Denford, this eviction guy? Are they two sides of the same coin? I mean, the thing is, Robin Denford comes along and evicts you, and then when you wind up on the streets, along comes Richard Hawkridge.
It does seem like there's pressure points from different organisations. You have Destination Bristol, whose managing director, John Hurst, referred to homeless as a terrorist threat, which is a great little quote there. He has featured in a few of Richard Hawkridge's court cases. I believe it. Not sure whether it's Robert Denford representing, but it is the council representing. We're letting them do that. We're letting them enforce on our behalf. As the people of Bristol, we're letting them go up to someone that's waiting for their benefits to go through and tell them to stop begging. I'm more than happy for someone to beg if they haven't got benefits through, and I'll stand in the way of any police or council member that wants to stop them doing that. But they act without any kind of transparency. No one can see this going on. No one knows it's happening, so they get away with it.
Well, a few more people know now. Also, injunctions, are they just specific places against specific people? How does an injunction work? Because remember, this is our council tax that's paying for these.
So our council tax has paid for an injunction on College Green, which is persons unknown, meaning anyone in College Green at any moment can be asked to leave due to the eviction papers.
What if you're a known person?
It doesn't matter whether you're known or unknown. They're creating entire areas where they can just pick and choose who they want to evict, using either bailiffs or supported by the police. It's been proved in court to be unenforceable. You can't just put a person's unknown eviction on an entire area a person's unknown injunction on an area for 6 months, because it's no way enforceable. I mean, I've been homeless once. If I go to College Green and have a sandwich, they're going to kick me off. Is that how it works? If I don't have a place to stay one day, do I go lie down there and they take me to jail?
Good to hear that some groups are doing things to alleviate problems, to actually help people who have no money. And let's face it, there's more and more people like that every day. The free shop is one of the things that BAM is doing, Bristol Housing Action.
A free shop to me is very similar to a clothes swap or any kind of, it's almost very anarchist in the way that it's set up, in that there's no money exchanged. You just come along. If you can take some of the donated pieces of clothes or otherwise, then fair play. If not, you can offer some words of support. It'll be at the Bear Pit. That's being organised by Bristol Housing Action Movement. And it's one of the things that we'd like to do a bit more than causing trouble, really, is to put on events like this that kind of give a lot back. Although the way we see it going into the next couple of months, we are going to see a lot of cold people on the streets, and I'm not going to let them stay on the streets.
What about donating to the free shop? Is that feasible? I mean, must be people out there who maybe got some spare winter clothes, if they may be buying something this autumn, last year's stuff, maybe looking for somewhere to live. And, you know, you can either take it along to a charity shop or maybe to the free shop.
Don't bring rubbish, but if you've got a decent coat or scarf or something like that, or you can go to a, You know, you've got friends that are dropping off some clothes or something to a charity shop. You could bring it down to the free shop first. Anything that doesn't get used, we're either put into storage or get to a charity shop anyway. It's what we could be doing as a city to combat the cuts, really, is a lot more of neighbourhood feeling and working with each other around each other. But then again, the Labour Party doesn't run that, do they? Nor does the Tory Party. So well, why would they endorse it?
It's interesting you say talk about the Labour Party, because most of the major cities, including Bristol, have got majority Labour administrations. Here we've got a Labour mayor. But it doesn't really quite feel like a Labour city. And it doesn't feel like this is the sort of Jeremy Corbyn-style Labour Party. So what's going on?
I mean, when you compare it to somewhere like Liverpool, that has almost seems to remember its history of radicalism a lot more. I feel like there's been certain people within the Labour Party in Bristol that have pushed certain kind of agendas. I mean, Marvin Rees, to my understanding, he wasn't a Labour man to start with. He was an independent that Labour poached. You've got him, Asher Craig, who he gets to put out all the consultations on parks, which was supposed to be out last year. The homelessness draft policy, that was supposed to be out on the 1st of October. The transport draft policy, which Mary Trefoil has been posting a lot about. I guarantee they'll get the wrong data, the data that they don't want. They need data to support whatever they're doing, it seems, but the people of Bristol aren't giving them what they need. So I imagine that'll be pushed and disappeared as well. It's just a real shame that these people, I think they genuinely think they're doing good, because that's how they've been raised. They've been raised to think that if you get enough investment into somewhere, somehow it will become a nice place. They haven't looked at any of the sociological impact of gentrification. They haven't looked at dissolving a place's culture, especially Bristol, which has a huge sound system culture, radicalisation of, you've got Hunts Abs, anti-fascists, you've got massive groups that kind of run out of Bristol, such as Boomtown Festival, various other festivals. It's a very individual place, and to come along with your degree from a business degree from a university and think that you can run a city complicated as Bristol by just getting investment from Malaysia is very strange.
Business apparently is the way. The city council is now saying that it wants the council to be run much more like a business. The only thing, of course, is you've got a different ethos in public service than you do in business.
Yes, and this neoliberal idea that you can get to 100% efficiency doesn't give people that 20% time to just rest and take a breather. And I mean, I work as a carpenter and an electrician, and sometimes you've just got to sit down and look at the wall that you're working on and think, how do I get that from A to B? And if you don't do that, everything goes wrong. If you're working at 100% efficiency day in, day out, what happens when someone's ill? Well, the buses don't run. What happens when summer comes around and it's too hot? The bins aren't picked up. So I understand that they're moving towards 100% efficiency, and fair play, get rid of the corruption within the council and you'll get closer to that. But to target frontline workers and to push the cuts onto those people, take the 100,000 that they paid the old city director before they left, which they didn't need to pay. Just stop paying managers 200,000. Why does it take 200,000 for someone to want to run a city? You have people out in Hartcliffe that would love to have a chance to contribute to the city and to change it and to make it into a better place. You could pay them £10 an hour or something similar. Why do you need to attract someone to run a city when they're already getting the status and the ability to turn up and do talks and other things anyway on the side?
Look, Bristol Housing Action, the free shop, whereabouts, just remind us whereabouts it all takes place. And if people are interested in homelessness and housing action, how do they get involved?
The free shop will be at 12 p.m. At the Bear Pit on the 20th of October, this Saturday. It will go on till about 5 o'clock. So if people are interested in donating clothes, learning a bit more about what's actually going on in the homeless circles of Bristol, learning about the organisations that they probably have a £10 direct debit set up to without even knowing how they're run. Learn a bit more about
the council. You're talking about shelter and crisis and people like that, or what?
Scent Mungos, the wonderful slum landlords that we have subcontracting our duty of care. If you're interested in having a natter, please come down. There may be a chance for some music and some food, which we're going to try and organise that as well. But going forward, it's got to a stage where discourse hasn't worked. We've sent the emails, we've sent the letters, our friends have died. Not happy.
What about actually going and meeting face-to-face with people from the City Council? They do these consultations, don't they? And Paul Smith is fairly accessible.
Yep, we've talked, they've talked, nothing's happened. So time for promises and I'll sort this out later is really gone. We have the power, all of us, the citizens of Bristol, to identify empty commercials. I'm going to say residentials because you might get yourself in trouble with the police. Identify empty commercials, find open windows, change locks, get homeless people in, move on to the next building.
And that is all perfectly legal, actually, isn't it? A lot of people don't realise this.
Completely legal. There's not going to be any problems with the police. And if you need help doing that, please get in contact and we'll be more than happy to help with it.
Richard Carey, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is George Samueli. I'm a fellow of the Global Policy Institute of London, and I'm the author of the book Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War in Yugoslavia. It was published by Amsterdam University Press in 2014. And the book focused on Western policy toward Yugoslavia, starting from the late 1980s through to the recognition of Kosovo in 2008 largely by the Western powers.
Now, the official version of events is effectively that after the death of Tito, slowly but surely, Yugoslavia, the various factions in the different regions started to fight amongst themselves, and eventually that led to a civil war, which led to the natural fragmentation of the country, which only Tito had been holding together. I wonder if you could just take us through give us your take of a kind of unofficial or an unauthorized version of what really happened.
Yes. The official Western version that you just presented has a rather unpleasant twist to it, which is that Yugoslavia was great while it was run by Tito, but when he died, sub-nationalism came to the fore, and it was somehow the Serbs wanted to come to dominate Yugoslavia. Tito had been a good guy. He had tried to suppress Serb nationalism, but now that he was no longer there, the Serbs were on the rampage and wanted to dominate Yugoslavia, dominate the other republics. And so they really had no course but to rebel against Serb rule and to exit Yugoslavia. So the Western powers had nothing to do with this. They just simply recognized reality that these unfortunate nations really had no choice but to seek independence. And in fact, to the contrary, the Western powers actually were in favor of keeping Yugoslavia together. That's the official version, and none of that is true. None of the story about the Serbs seeking to dominate Yugoslavia was untrue, and it was actually a story that was put about by the various nationalist factions that came to the fore in the other republics, particularly in Croatia. And the Western powers played a very significant role in the breakup of Yugoslavia. They encouraged the nationalist tendencies. And when the conflict arose between the government in Belgrade, which was the federal government of Belgrade, and the various nationalist factions in the republics, the Western powers rushed to assist the nationalists.
So can you name any one particular point where you think the fighting of the conflict really started? Because obviously there have been rivalries and rivalries, but eventually it broke out into civil war.
Right. Well, the most significant event was the period from 1990 to 1991. In 1990, these were the first post-communist elections that took place.
Can you just remind us when Tito died? Was it in the 80s?
Yeah, no, Tito died already sometime earlier. Tito died in 1980. And then Yugoslavia had kind of muddled along through the 1980s. It did have serious economic problems, much of it stemming from the very substantial debt that it had accumulated in previous decades.
I mean, but Yugoslavia also had quite an interesting character, didn't it? Because they famously stood up to Stalin after the Second World War, really daring him to invade them, and they would give Stalin the same treatment that they'd given Hitler. That's what Tito said. And and there was an interesting half mix, really, between the more authoritarian kind of communism that you got in the Soviet Union and a kind of enlightened, shall we say, leftist trade union rights, you know, quite a lot of rights in Yugoslavia itself. So can you, before we talk about, I know I did ask you that question, which I probably, probably a little bit premature, but I think this is the interesting thing about Yugoslavia for me anyway, was that they had this kind of almost unique model in the world of economic development.
Yes, that's absolutely right in what you've just alluded to, because it did indeed defy Stalin in 1948, and face a serious prospect of an invasion. I mean, this was no joke. I mean, this was Stalin at the height of his powers. And then subsequently, they did develop their own kind of communism. It was called a kind of, there was some autonomy within the republics, and there was, workers' control. And so, yes, there was communist rule, but domestically, it was fairly tolerant. At times, the some dissent broke out, and it seemed to get out of control, and then Tito would crack down. But by and large, it was a pretty decent, tolerant place. Yugoslavs were free to travel to other countries, and culturally, it was also a very interesting place because they were making a lot of very interesting movies. And there was a time in the 1960s and 70s when the hippest thing that you could do was to go watch some movies from Yugoslavia, particularly like films of Dušan Makavejev. And so it did have that kind of rather an interesting place. It was tolerant, quite liberal. There was this, workers' control. So it was an alternative model to the Soviet system that prevailed in Moscow and in the other East European states.
So you mentioned that there'd been a debt. I mean, I imagine that would start to cripple such a model, even if it was being quite successful in Tito's era.
Well, yeah, no, that's right. That is in fact what happened. So during the 1980s, when the debt crisis, which affected Latin America, but affected Yugoslavia also, the countries were placed under pressure from the banks and their representative, the International Monetary Fund, to pay off their debts. And of course, the IMF adopted the usual remedies of austerity, driving down currencies, putting people out of work, closing down industries, and so on. Of course, that did create quite a bit of political tension among the republics. In particular, some of the more prosperous republics, namely Croatia and Slovenia, which felt that they didn't, why should they carry the burden of the inefficiencies of the other republics? So it was a familiar kind of political tension that attends these IMF-style remedies.
Okay, so you're painting a picture here of quite a successful country up until 1980, and Tito dies, and then a decade of difficulties.
Slowly but surely,
the screws are being tightened, and then in 1981 it snaps. How did it snap?
the way it sat was that the IMF had actually sought to centralize Yugoslavia. They felt that there had been actually too much autonomy within Yugoslavia. And so therefore, it was very hard for Yugoslavia to service its debt if the republics could pursue their own independent economic policies. So the IMF was actually recommending to the government in Belgrade to centralize the economy, particularly centralize the currency and the central bank. And so this fueled the tension between Belgrade and the independent republics. None of this really had anything to do with Serbia, the Serbs, and the other nations. I mean, this was really the tension between the multinational, multi-republic federal government in Belgrade and the individual republics. And so there was tension between Belgrade and Croatia and Slovenia, the two most prosperous republics. They felt that they didn't want to subsidize the rest of the country. But there was also tension with provinces that were poorer than the rest, in particular Kosovo, where there were a lot of the smokestacked industries, mines and so on, that the IMF was recommending that they be closed. Kosovo's problems with Belgrade were different from the problems of Croatia and Slovenia with Belgrade.
Now, I mean, maybe you could just explain. It would seem to me that if a country is to pick itself up from an economic difficulty, that actually keeping raw materials, things like mines, open would actually be aiding that process and not. Why on earth were the IMF saying close these mines?
Well, yeah, but they were wedded to this, what we call a neoliberal ideology, which is that, if it's inefficient, then let's close it down, or let's bring in foreign investors who would close down most of the mine, just keep a few profitable things going, and then privatize the rest. So that was the ideology they were wedded to, and it did indeed lead to a massive closure of the industries that Yugoslavia had built up in previous decades. Much the same kind of policy that was pursued in the former Soviet Union. Again, let's close down everything that's inefficient and, we'll privatize the rest. And anything that's no good, we'll just simply sell off and see what we can get for it. And just as in the former Soviet Union, it created all manner of political tension. In Yugoslavia, it was in some ways even more acute.
What about how the war developed? Because NATO got quite seriously involved, didn't they? I can remember back in 1999, for example, hearing mm-hmm. US jets flying overhead over the top of London, heading for yes. Kosovo.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was, of course, later, because up until 1991, that was in 1991, Croatia and Slovenia declared their independence, and the NATO powers, or the Western powers, essentially sided with Croatia and Slovenia rather than do what you would expect states that respect international law do, which is say, well, let's have a cooling down period. Let's sit and negotiate. No one should just rush into anything. Much is kind of what the EU policy has been on Catalonia recently. They pretty much said, okay, great. Croatia, Slovenia want to go their own way. Let's just fine. Let them do it. And in no time at all. So Croatia and Slovenia declared their independence in June of 1991. In December 1991, barely 6 months that had elapsed, Germany had recognized their independence, and within 1 month after that, the rest of the EU followed Germany in recognizing their independence. I mean, it was the most extraordinary support for the dissolution of a state.
Why did they do that?
I think that at that moment in 1990, 1991, 1992, they thought this was a great historic opportunity for the West to expand its power and influence. And they thought they wouldn't be able to get another chance like this again. They did the same thing in the Soviet Union as well, that the moment countries declared their independence, the Western powers rushed to recognize that independence. And really, without any serious negotiation about the terms of the independence, all the various issues about minorities and about debts, how the debts are going to be distributed and so on, without any serious negotiation, the Western powers just said, okay, we're going to recognize your independence. The difference in the case of the former Soviet Union was that the leadership there, the leadership around Boris Yeltsin, seemed okay with this breakup. It was quite an extraordinary, pathetic leadership. But Belgrade tried to resist this. And when it did try to resist this breakup, the Western powers rushed and said that they will not accept any kind of use of force to prevent this breakup. And that, of course, was all that, you know, the Belgrade government just said, well, if we're not allowed to use force, then, the hell with it. We're not going to do anything to resist this. So the federal army, the Yugoslav army, made some token attempts to prevent the dissolution of Yugoslavia, but, it gave up rather quickly. What then happened was that the Serbs, the substantial, which was a substantial minority in a number of the republics in Croatia, but very much so in Bosnia, kind of felt that, well, if we're to allow republics to secede, if we allow national self-determination for Croatia and Slovenia, why can't we allow national self-determination for the Serbs? I mean, the Serbs in Croatia didn't want to remain part of Croatia, and Serbs in Bosnia didn't particularly want to be a part of an independent Bosnia. So that kind of fueled the subsequent wars.
Did they not, though, have their own state, the Serbs?
Well, they had their state, which was Serbia, but they were a very substantial minority in other countries, in the other countries. What were the republics of the former Yugoslavia. So that wasn't a problem as long as the common state of Yugoslavia was in existence. But once that had gone, they were now a minority in somebody else's state. And in particular in Croatia, that raised a real problems because their memories of the last time Croatia was an independent state, which was during World War II, their memories of that was pretty terrible. I mean, this was a Nazi-aligned state. There was massacres of Serbs. There was the Jasenovac death camps and so on. So the Serbs really just opted out. They said they really didn't want to be a part of this independent state of Croatia. But it became really problematic in Bosnia, where the Serbs had, up until fairly recently, recent times, had actually been the majority population in Bosnia. By 1991, there were about 30% of the population. But nonetheless, that's a very substantial minority. And they also really didn't want to be a part of this state of Bosnia, particularly one that was ruled by somebody who had some Islamist tendencies, namely Alija Izetbegović.
Now, I understand also that there was another ingredient in all this, and that is the Muslims, mostly mm-hmm. Bosnian Muslims. Is there any truth to some of the things I've read that say that some of these Bosnian Muslims were actually trained by the Americans over in Afghanistan to fight the Russians? And then once, obviously the Russians had disappeared by 2001, but actually in the 1990s, some of them actually came over trained by the CIA, trained by US Special Forces to get stuck in Yugoslavia.
Yes, I think that is true. I think there was a very important element in the Bosnian Muslim army of these jihadists who had been trained by the CIA and who were, as we see in Syria today, were particularly vicious in the way they fought. And the United States was quite happy with this. I mean, Holbrooke, in his account of Yugoslavia said, well, that was okay. I mean, we brought in these jihadis. It was the same as when we were fighting against Hitler in World War II. You know, we sided with Stalin. So, you know, we sometimes have to side with bad people against even worse people. I mean, the sheer mentality of comparing the Serbs to the Nazis is just it's just bizarre. But yeah, there was a very large proportion of the Muslim army were these jihadis. I mean, Osama bin Laden was you know, there'd be any number of reports that bin Laden himself was in Sarajevo during those years, and in fact after the 9/11 attacks that was in 2001. The presence of these jihadis in Sarajevo became an embarrassment, and so the U.S. kind of put pressure on the government there to, well, can you just get rid of them, because this is really awkward for us. We're supposedly fighting this global war on terror, and yet here they are, you know, living quite happily in Sarajevo. So they got rid of a few people, but a number of them stayed on.
Now, there were NATO, I understand, UN peacekeeping forces, mostly from NATO countries. But to what extent is NATO's hand, can you see that now, all these years after the conflict in the late 1990s?
Well, NATO's hand was very important in all of that, because the way it worked with the United Nations was that, I mean, you had these UN peacekeepers in Croatia, because there was a kind of a ceasefire. So you had the Serb majority areas, and then you had the rest of Croatia. So when President Tudjman mounted an offensive in 1995 against the Serb areas, he pretty much just defied the United Nations, which had actually sent the peacekeepers there, and just drove out the Serbs from Croatia, ended these Serb autonomous areas. And NATO, particularly the United States and Germany, were perfectly happy with this. They were great. They were so driven by their anti-Serb animus that they didn't raise any serious objection to this offensive against these Serb autonomous areas, which had been set up by the United Nations. And in Bosnia, you had the United Nations peacekeepers there, and again, that NATO wanted to essentially push back against the Serbs. They largely wanted the Bosnian Muslims to win the war, while the United Nations was actually trying to keep the peace. There was a lot of tension between NATO and the UN, because the UN said, hey, we have our mandate, we're supposed to be here keeping the peace, and NATO wants the Bosnian Muslims to win the war. And it led eventually to the ouster of Boutros Ghali, the UN Secretary General, because the Americans were just so furious at his refusal to go along with their plans.
Now, NATO, if they were with us today on the mm-hmm. on the line, let's hope they're not, you never know, but if they were, they would tell you that the real criminals were mostly the Serbs. In fact, you've also got people like Slobodan Milosevic, Radovan Karadzic, and also that poor chap that committed suicide live on television at mm-hmm. The Hague, that these people are war criminals, and they've all been lawfully tried and found guilty.
That's exactly what NATO would say. And, of course, none of it is true, because the Serbs, and in particular Milosevic, had actually supported all of the peace plans that were put forward during those years. The people who actually opposed the peace plans were the Muslims and their sponsors in the Clinton administration. So if one goes through the history of all the peace plans that were put forward, whether it was the Vance-Owen plan, the Owen-Stoltenberg plan, the contact group plan, the EU action plan, there were a number of them put forward. Milosevic himself, he signed off on all of them. Whereas the Muslim, in particular, rejected nearly all of them. And even back then, back in 1992, when the war could have been averted, when there was the there was a plan put forward by Cutillero, it was the famous Cutillero plan, which could have averted the war. And Izet Begovic had in fact signed that agreement, but then under pressure from the Americans, he withdrew his signature. So if we look at what actually took place during those years, we had the Americans who were encouraging this war to continue in the hope that somehow they would secure their geopolitical goals through a defeat of the Serbs.
What about Milosevic? Some people say he was poisoned whilst in custody at The Hague.
Well, his death was very peculiar. I mean, he had a heart condition. He had a heart condition when he arrived at The Hague, and then he had asked for medical treatment. And the Hague, the judges said, no, we can provide you with this medical treatment here at The Hague. He didn't really get any of this medical treatment. So he had more doctors come in and look at him and say, look, he really needs special medical treatment. So again, The Hague refused this. And then he wrote a letter to the judges and to the Russians saying that, well, they found this particular peculiar thing in my blood. And I don't know what the hell that is. It's basically kind of anti-leprosy kind of medication. And then a few days later, he died. And then the Hague, which is always allowed to investigate itself, he said, oh, well, if this thing was found in his blood, then Milosevic must have administered it himself in order to, ensure that his health deteriorated further, and so he'd be able to get out and do his medical treatment. But The Hague never presented any evidence for why Milosevic would do this. There's no evidence at all that Milosevic was self-medicating. And so the mystery of how this rifampicin, this thing, was in his blood remains. And his death was pretty sudden. And, it took place really just a few days after the court had rejected his appeal to go get special medical treatment.
I mean, what stage was that in the trial? Was he actually going through an appeal against the decision?
No, there hadn't been a judgment yet. So this was still... It was still in the defense phase of the trial. It was coming to an end.
The Hague must have realized that he would almost certainly appeal that. So, it does sound to me as if possibly the Hague judges, the people that run the International War Crimes Tribunal there, might actually themselves be guilty of potentially of murder and of a war crime.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what can you do? They are allowed to investigate themselves. And, of course, when they investigate themselves, they always absolve themselves. I mean, there have been any number of deaths in The Hague. I mean, so it's, the record of actually people dying is in their prison is quite bleak. But every time they investigate themselves, they, of course, absolve themselves. No, we did everything by the book. They got the best medical treatment available and so on. And the media, as usual, just simply, write it up. Yep, best medical treatment available. It's a first-rate prison and, nothing to see here, folks. So, these things happen. And there's not a lot one can do about it. I mean, there's no oversight.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Rick Carey from BAM, that's Bristol Housing Action Movement, and also to George Samueli, but his name is spelt S-Z-A-M-U-E-L-Y. That's George, S-Z-A-M-U-E-L-Y. George Samueli, geopolitical analyst, writes for antiwar.com, and is the author of the 2013 book Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. Also thanks to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can talk to PRSC Arts Centre on 0117 909 6897. Volunteer with us if you like, or for hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Their hands in their pockets.